welcome back to another episode of Anarcho Book Club. So today, we're going to keep working through Leaves of Grass by Walt Whitman. And I posted a poem on Mastodon that, if you're following me there, you will have seen, To the States. And I want to start with that one. And since it's a short poem, I'll just read it here. So let's just jump right in. To the States, or any one of them, or any city of the states. Resist much, obey little. Once unquestioning obedience, once fully enslaved. Once fully enslaved, no nation, state, city of this earth, ever after resumes its liberty. And I think, though short, that poem is very telling of the mindset of at least Whitman, if not also of that age. So I've got pulled up here just a little biography by Wikipedia of Walt Whitman. He was born in 1819, and maybe I should have done this before, but here we are. And he died in 1892. And when he wrote this poem, it would have been right before the Civil War began, just a few years. And it seems to me kind of odd, I guess. Although, see, here's the thing. Earlier we talked about Emma Goldman sort of, if not idolizing Whitman, at least trying to embody what she perceived as his great strength as America's most pronounced, well, now most pronounced and most well-known poet. So I think to review him as an anarchist may be a little bit assumptive of his actual role. I think he is a stepping stone towards anarchy, but I don't think he is. And part of the proof I have is the next poem that is I'm going to connect to what we just read. And in fact, it's not a long poem either, so I'll just go ahead and read it. It's about Abraham Lincoln, I believe on the anniversary of his death, if I'm not mistaken. And it's called, O Captain, My Captain. And here it is. O Captain, my Captain, our fearful trip is done. The ship has weathered every rack, the prize we sought is won. The port is near, the bells I hear, the people all exulting. While follow eyes the steady keel, the vessel grim and daring. But oh heart, 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 oh the bleeding drops of red, where on the deck my captain lies fallen cold and dead. Oh captain, my captain, rise up and hear the bells. Rise up, for you the flag is flung, for you the bugle trills. For you bouquets and ribboned wreaths, for you the shores a-crowding, for you they call the swaying mass, their eager faces turning. Here, Captain, dear father, this arm beneath your head, it is some dream that on the deck you've fallen cold and dead. My captain does not answer, his lips are pale and still. My father does not feel my arm, he has no pulse nor will. The ship is anchored safe and sound, its voyage closed and done. From fearful trip, the victor ship comes in with object won. Exult, O shores, and ring, O bells, but I, with mournful tread, walk the deck my captain lies, fallen, cold, and dead. And I think that connects well with his previous exhortation of the states to resist. Because if you're a student of history, you'll know that with Lincoln came sort of a lockdown, came a concentration of power at the very top. And although the power was there, it wasn't nearly as strong before Lincoln launched his war against the South. And I don't mean to be a Southern apologist, and I don't mean to excuse anything that the Southern states were doing, because they too are, they were led by powers that would oppress. Neither side, in my opinion, was on the right. or on the correct path, to be more exact. But a more grievous error in judgment, I think, came from Lincoln, because whenever he blockaded the ports to the south to starve them out and force them to bend to the will of the North, the rich, the, you may call it, the bourgeois and the upper classes, when he did that, he set in motion something that could not be avoided, and that was a war that had nothing to do with slavery whatsoever. The war was not initiated nor fought because some people wanted to free slaves and some people wanted to keep hold on them. Not in the most literal sense. The war was fought, the Civil War. It was fought to take hold and consolidate power at the top. Not just with the president and the federal Congress and the Supreme Court, which at that time, again, or around that time, judgments were being made that consolidated power in the nine men that were selected. But rather, the war was fought. It was a fight against, and this is what the Southerners, at least, something that modern Americans who fly the rebel flag and claim whatever it is they claim, they don't seem to understand is the Southerners fought, at least the common man fought, because they were under the impression, and I don't think it was the wrong impression, they were under the impression that the North, the Northern capitalists, the Northern industrialists, wanted to hold them down and keep them from producing the goods they needed to survive. And this has been the way it has been since the very founding of the nation. The South has always been sort of the, what would you call, the red-headed stepchild. It has always been the shame of the North. And now the propaganda that's been written since has turned the Civil War, especially in primary school and in high schools, you're taught that the Civil War was fought, Lincoln fought against the South to free the slaves, but he didn't. It wasn't until the very end of the war that he made his speech, the speech that is immortalized now in the halls of Congress. And that speech was to free the slaves, or at least to emancipate them from those who would control them in the South, which would be the people that he's fighting. And the reasons given, if not in the speech, the reasons explained through letters and so on, were it was sort of the same thing that Lincoln allowed with Sherman's March to the Sea. It was a virtual way to burn the crops and starve them out, starve the South out. And you see, what the Civil War was fought over, in the end, was not slaves. That was just a means to an end. That was just a means to consolidate power and create a singular nation. Because before the Civil War, every state acted as if it were a nation. It was a confederation, or a federation, as it were, of individual countries under a singular government, which promoted more freedom. And that's why we read earlier from "To the States, to resist much and obey little." That was Whitman's exhortation to the states and to the cities, and I would assume also to the individuals in those cities and in the countryside. And you see, Whitman embodies in this short four-stanza poem, he embodies the spirit of the states at the time. The states, northern and southern alike, were fighting for their independence as individual entities. And by doing that, they were in effect fighting for the independence of the individual as well. And this is where I can sort of... I can see why Emma Goldman seemed to love Whitman so much. Because he was exhorting the states to fight for these things. And... But then I get confused, to be honest with you, because whenever he writes the O Captain, My Captain poem, it sounds like he's praising a dear leader, a leader who basically smashed everything that he, everything that Whitman exhorted the states to do. He smashed it, brought everything under a singular government, and then, of course, future presidents, I think it was Grant, did the... the rebuilding of the South. Now I've forgotten what it's called. And that basically demolished the economy of the South. Any economy that was left after the war was demolished by the Reconstruction. That's what it was. By the Reconstruction. And it solidified the power of the economy to the top level. And who do you think controls the top level after the war? Well, you've got your old bugaboos. You have your Carnegie. You have your J.P. Morgans. Your Vanderbilts. You have all these people who basically the tycoons of industry, as it were. And they control, well, everything. And you have, well, and then you have, say, a few years later, Theodore Roosevelt comes into play. And he acts as if he is smashing up the trusts, the monopolies. And sure, on the surface, he does. He breaks down Vanderbilt. He breaks down J.P. Morgan. He breaks them all down on the surface. In the end, they benefit more than if Theodore Roosevelt, had never challenged them at all. And I don't think that was an accident. I think it was Theodore Roosevelt was probably a wolf in sheep's clothing. And that takes us to the end of that poem, to the states. Once fully enslaved, no nation, state, city of this earth ever afterward resumes its liberty. And that's the truth. Once you hand over control to those that would dominate over you, whether it be a state, a nation, whether it be a corporation or a tycoon, or whether it simply be to another individual. Once you let them have full control over you, good luck getting your liberty back. Good luck getting any modicum of individuality back. It may happen, but then that's why Jefferson, in the very beginning, though I'm not a huge fan of his, it's the same with any anarchist or any philosopher that you read. Even if they have a singular idea that just completely, it makes you think of them as a disgusting person or someone not to be trusted. That doesn't mean that everything they wrote was evil or everything they wrote was worthless. And the same is true with Jefferson, in my mind. He wrote that, and I'm going to have to paraphrase here because I don't have it pulled up. This is sort of a spur-of-the-moment thought. He wrote that He wrote that liberty must be refreshed occasionally with blood. And so maybe that's the only way you can eventually regain your liberty. I don't know. I am not one of the great philosophers, I don't think, and so I haven't put much thought to that idea, but it seems probable to me that is the case, that a person's liberty, an anarchist liberty, maybe occasionally must be refreshed and restored with blood, with sacrifice. Because if we look, as I mentioned many times probably in the last couple of episodes, if we look through the history of humanity, it always does seem to be a common archetypal event in history that the only way to break the chains that are around your neck and ankles is to cut off the hand that's holding them. That seems to be a common thing throughout mythology and history. And it's only through struggle, it's only through great resistance, it's only through great sacrifice that you can regain your liberty or the thing that we are all born with. Individuality, it may be called, but I think that's too limiting. Liberty is a good word, though it has been stained over the course of time. And I think he's right. It's much of the time, those that are enslaved, those that are subservient to a corporation, let's think about Google and Apple and Microsoft. Microsoft's a big one. Those who are enslaved to Microsoft because they must use their computers or their programs, and they have no choice because they don't know any better. They don't know a better way. They are enslaved, and if they don't know how to get out of it, and they don't know that they can free themselves with free software, with, like what I use, Slackware, or what others use, Arch, or Elementary OS, or Ubuntu, all of these Linux OSs, or the BSDs, if they don't know that they can free themselves, then they'll never try. But as soon as people begin to use an overused phrase, to wake up, as soon as they begin to wake up to the reality around them that they do have a choice in the software that they use, or they do have a choice in the corporations from which they buy, they do have a choice to borrow from Ayn Rand, to shrug off this oppression, to shrug off the chains. They do have that choice, and maybe it's not going to be comfortable, but that's okay, because that's the next step, and it's always the next step throughout history. In mythology, there's always a struggle, there's always a fight, a sacrifice. And this is all to extend upon what Whitman has written down for us. Although it seems, and the reason why I brought up O Captain, My Captain, it seems like perhaps he wasn't willing, and I'm not sure, I haven't read all of the histories around him. I've really only ever read Leaves of Grass before about him, and a short blurb on Wikipedia. But it seems to me that later he goes back on this idea to shrug off the chains, or at least to resist much and obey little. And he glorifies Lincoln, and he's one of the few poets of the time that was fairly well recognized by anarchists and by those that allow themselves to be subjugated by the state alike. It seems that he goes back on that, and I'm not exactly sure why. Or maybe I'm misinterpreting to the states. Perhaps I am. But I think there's still something in it. Such a small poem has so much effect and gets the gears turning. And I sort of wanted to move on and get to other poems as well, but I think this is a good little snapshot in Leaves of Grass. And we're still in the beginning. We haven't even gotten to Song of Myself, which is probably the most popular segment of this collection. But there's another poem before we get to Song of Myself, which we won't get to in this episode, I don't think. There's another poem that kind of goes along with To the States, and much before, far before O Captain, My Captain, that builds upon To the States. It's called To a Certain Cantatrice. Here, take this gift. I was reserving it for some hero, speaker, or general. One who should serve the good old cause, the great idea, the progress and freedom of the race. Some brave confronter of despots, some daring rebel. But I see that what I was reserving belongs to you just as much as to any. And so that poem, also quite short, builds upon it. And this again touches on mythology. In mythology, many times, if not almost all times, it is always there's always a hero to a story. There's always a hero that takes it upon themselves to defeat some evil in the world, be it a despot or be it a great evil wizard or whatever it be, a dragon, as it were. And what he's saying is, in this poem, that is reserved for everyone, for anyone who's willing to take on the dragons. That is, it is a gift that he gives as a poet, because he is the poet, he is the writer of mythology, he is the recorder of history, and he was reserving this gift for someone, some great hero, for his epic. And he says, this is for you, that you, dear listener, that you, any reader of this poem. He's reserving this gift for you to challenge the despots, to become the daring rebel. He's giving it to anyone as an impartial observer, as a poet. And then he goes on in the very next poem with a common trope in mythology, to return to nature. In the next poem, let me see, it's Me Imperturbe. I believe is, I don't know, that may not even be Me Imperturbe. And I won't read this one, it's quite long. Well, it's not actually that long, but it's too long to read out. But he returns to nature. He stands at ease in nature, as he says. Things like his occupation, or poverty, or notoriety, foibles, crimes, are less important than I thought. And he can travel from here to the Mexican Sea, or to the Manhattan, or to the Tennessee, or far north inland, traveling on rivers. He's speaking as one, as a river traveler. It reminds me of the film Chocolat, where you have the river rats, and they travel all over the country on their flat boats, flat bottom boats. I forget what they call them. They look like skiffs to me, but they travel all over the country on the river boats, and sort of like the Romani people travel all over the country in their wagons. And you're at one with nature, in his mind. And this is the part of Whitman that attracts me so very much, is being at one with nature. Not there is no forcing your will upon another person. Whenever you accept nature and accept the rules of nature, you might say, or the laws of nature, I guess you might say, there's no forcing your will upon someone without consequence. Whereas in today's world, we have things, well, in most of history's world, we have had these things called governments who have a monopolization of force, and everything they do is derived from the force that they have. In the Roman Empire, or in the Roman government system, everything they did, though it was a republic as we see it today, everything they did was through the rule of force. They had a sword, and they could put that sword to anyone without much resistance. Except for there were uprisings, and in the end it was their downfall. But throughout most of their history, the Pax Romana, the peace of Rome, was spread throughout the world via war, and they say this was 200 years that the world saw peace. But in truth, it was 200 years of continual war to keep the barbarian at bay, to keep that which is one with nature, that which roams the earth, and which, if my history is, if you read Germanicus' history of the Northmen, and you see, they had a system, they had a self-governance model, where natural leaders rose up, but it was only amongst a few, a handful of people, and they had a system of mutual aid that we all seem, as anarchists, seem to idealize. And though it wasn't perfect, because no organization of humankind is perfect, though it wasn't perfect, it worked quite well for them. Now, they didn't have massive advancements because of it, but they were able to resist the Roman Empire stretching up into their lands for hundreds of years, in fact. And eventually they were the ones that migrated down and sacked Rome. Three times, if I'm not wrong, if I'm not mistaken. Three times they sacked Rome. And this is what I think, these are the things I think of whenever I read this poem about sort of a return to nature, finding your occupation, your poverty, your notoriety, your foibles, your crimes, less important. And think about it. Your occupation, your job, what do you do? I wish I could say that all I did was podcasting, but then I'm finding my occupation maybe a little bit more important than I ought. But what do you do? Are you a warehouse worker? Are you maybe a roofer? Maybe you work at Starbucks. Maybe you work at McDonald's. Maybe you don't have a job. And maybe that puts you in poverty. Or maybe having a job also keeps you in poverty. And because there's no room for advancement, there's no room to earn more for as a product of your labor. And your foibles, or your crime, foibles, the things being, well, here, let me pull up an actual definition of it. Let's see, foibles, a minor weakness or eccentricity in someone's character. So, what would you say? Maybe you pick your nose, or maybe you have an addiction to cigarettes or alcohol. These are, and maybe those aren't as minor as I'm playing them off to be, but let's just go with that. Those are your foibles. And maybe they're not as important as you think they are. Maybe they're not something that you should spend so much time worrying about whenever you can have greater purpose. You can have a greater purpose than getting a house, or you can have greater purpose than getting that job, that career. Because what is it in the end? What is that career in the end? Is that life? Is it? Because, so I finally gotten a job that I enjoy quite a lot, and it is in tech, and it is stressful. But is that life? Is it still life? Or is it just a means to an end? For me, any job is a means to an end. Having a job allows me to pay for electricity so that I can, and internet connection, so that I can record this podcast and then upload it have it there for archival sake. And hopefully someone listens to this and they find it interesting. That would be nice. And maybe I can help just one person kind of understand ideas of generic anarchism. Because if you haven't noticed, this podcast is not about a specific flavor of anarchism. It is about a broad spectrum of anarchism. We study all the anarchists and non-anarchists, for that matter. If you've not noticed, I'm not entirely certain Walt Whitman would have ever called himself an anarchist. In fact, I'm fairly certain he wouldn't have called himself that. But he was a man of nature. I have multiple other authors in mind to go over that are similar. But he was a man of nature. He was a man of not just nature. He went to nature. What does he say? He went to the woods. I believe this was him. I went to the woods to live deliberately. Because he wanted to live. He wanted to live. That's the right word. I don't know how else to explain it exactly. He wanted, in these poems we've read, to resist, and that you can be the hero, and that maybe your poverty or your occupation should not, though it does concern you, your poverty, for instance, if you are living paycheck to paycheck, or living on other people's kindness, sure, that does affect you a lot. Maybe it takes up a lot of room in your mind. But what he's imploring his reader to do is to find life, to find a meaning in life, and to suck the marrow out of life. And I could be completely wrong, but I think that was also him that said, suck the marrow out of life. I can't remember. It's been, like I said, it's been a long time, and I've read a lot of poets since. So it could all just be melding together right now. But he wants you to suck the marrow out of life and on your off day, on the day, this is what I do on my off day, but on your off day, do something that gives you joy. Do something like, for me, it's podcast or recording these thoughts, because I don't even know if I could call this a pod. It's only a podcast because that's the best form I can think of to deliver it. But these are more just a recording of my thoughts. And I do this, and I love to go hiking. I love to go to the woods to live deliberately, to walk amongst the trees, to climb up peaks, and not for the sake of some sort of adrenaline rush, not for the sake of conquering that next goal. I'm not a goal-driven person, to be completely honest. What I enjoy is going to the woods, going out on a trail, or not a trail, it doesn't even have to be a trail, going out where the distractions, I would say they're minimal, but they're not, where the only distractions are birds, or trees creaking, or a creek babbling. That's something I find great joy in. That's something that I find to give me a true sense of meaning, a true sense of life. Maybe not meaning, but life. And so that's what he's once again exhorting his reader to do, is to find something. For him, and maybe it wasn't for him, maybe he's writing about a river wanderer, as it were, a river man, as he says. Maybe, but, I mean, either way, he's saying to go out and find something that gives you meaning. My occupation ends at a certain time and begins at a certain time. And the rest of the time, that's for me. And maybe this is, you think, this is philosophy that's taking away, it's diverting from the path of anarchism into some other kind of philosophy. But I'm here to tell you that all philosophy, I believe, at least all individualist philosophy or introspective philosophy, all philosophy is a part of anarchism. It is a part of being, and I don't even know, I think I said this before, I'm not even sure that anarchism is a real thing. I don't think it is, to be honest with you. I think it's just simply being human and living a life where you want to be free. In fact, I think I said this exact thing in the last recording of my thoughts. And so that's why it's easy for me to read Walt Whitman and see quote-unquote anarchist ideals, anarchist ideas, anarchist philosophies within his words. And the same is true for whenever I studied Shakespeare years ago. It's been a while. I still have the book, in fact, of all his works. And I studied Shakespeare, and there were so many philosophical ideals and ideas packed in the words of his characters, in the words of Shakespeare. And at the time, I saw them as some abstract idea, some abstract notion of philosophy. But now, I see those things, and I realize how would I put it? They are simply a philosophy for the individual, for the as some of my anarchist friends would call, the common man, or the proletariat. But they are also for the bourgeois. They're also for anyone, for that matter. It doesn't have to be us versus them. It only, in my mind, to be an anarchist, it's about what is best in my life for me, and what is best in my life for those around me. Because I can't affect you 1,000 miles away by my own actions. Perhaps I can by recording this and you listen to it and I affect you, but that's not, I mean, on a simpler scale, whenever you buy a product, you can affect your local market, if you will. You can affect your local market by buying from a specific vendor. Perhaps it's your friend, or perhaps it's your a local farmer, and you can affect their lives. You're not going to affect the life of the farmer who's growing 50,000 acres of wheat or of corn by buying a loaf of bread or by buying an ear of corn. Not very much. And even if you did, I would say that was probably not the best use of this fictional thing we call money. This representation of value that's decided by someone other than ourselves. It's a great spiderweb, you see. So if you use that fictional thing called money that represents some sort of value that is not decided by you to buy from a local farmer, you have increased his wealth or his monetary value quite a bit more than you would if you bought, say, what is a common brand? I'm not even sure. Green Giant corn? I think that's a brand. Or whatever it is. You can affect him more, and that affects you in your community. And there's a mutual gain there. And I'm not going to claim that that's a form of mutual aid, but it sometimes makes me think that buying local, or this whole movement of buy local, isn't in some abstract way a form of mutual aid. Because whenever it comes right down to it, it's the people around you that are going to affect your life in the short span that you have on this earth. Whenever it comes right down to it, helping out your neighbor will affect your life and their life a whole hell of a lot more than giving a dollar to charity. Now, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't give a dollar to some charitable organization, but don't shun your neighbor in order to give your dollar to some nameless organization that uses 60% of their funds to pay their CEO and so on, when you can just help your neighbor. The other day, I was sitting here, getting ready to record, in fact, and it just snowed a lot. And, I mean, the snow had to have been, after the plow went through, it was up to my waist, everywhere but the roads, or on the side of the roads. Car needed to get through to get to her driveway, or a lady needed to get through in her car. She thought she would go through, and she thought if she went fast enough, she could make it through. Well, it wasn't the case, and I saw her out my window. And I thought, you know, I can sit here and record my thoughts for others to listen to and keep talking about it all I want. And I didn't actually think these precise thoughts, but this is what I thought afterwards as to why I impulsively jumped up and went out and helped dig her car out. It was because she is my neighbor, and we live in a community of sorts. Although we don't talk much, especially with COVID, we don't really get together and have meetings. But we live in a community where at least we know, or at least we want to know, that we can trust the people next door, or the people across the street. And afterwards I thought, it was better for me to help her right now, here and now, because it helps me, and it helps everyone in the community feel safer. And in the future, they may help me, or I may need their help. And this is the whole idea. I don't need to rehash the whole idea of mutual aid. But we all help each other, especially in your community, because that's where you can have the most effect. And I've gotten way off topic now. I know I have. But those are the things you can do to find life. These are some of the things to find a true sense of life. One of the things that the Soviet Union was missing was a sense of life, as it can be seen in Ayn Rand's book, We the Living. You can see, through her perspective at least, that there was no individual existed exactly in the Soviet Union. And this is recounted many, many times in other people's memoirs and other people's biographies and so on. But I think her book really encapsulates the whole thing. That there was no individual, per se, and because of that, no individual ever attempted to find a sense of life. Now, what she extrapolated out of that, I find wanting. Her whole idea of objectivism, although it is attractive in some ways, I find the whole thing wanting of, it's wanting of the human element. And perhaps that's because she had that beaten out of her as a child in the Soviet Union. She had that wrung out of her by the state, the Soviet state, but that sense of humanity. But that's not what I'm here to talk to comment on. What I'm here to comment on is through her perspective, no one had this sense of life. No one went to the woods to live deliberately. No one sounded their barbaric yop from the rooftops of the world. No one found that which could make them feel alive. And I think that's what these series of poems that we've covered today really seems to embody in a way, in a sense. So I think that might be a good place to leave it, in fact, because next we're going to... I've read through and I've gotten to Song of Myself. I think I'm just going to cover Song of Myself next time. And then after that, we can get on with finishing it up on the next episode. So that'll be 4 episodes on Leaves of Grass altogether. So I'll finish this up here. I'll leave this off here. And I hope you guys enjoyed this. I really do. I don't... Like I said earlier, this isn't... To me, it's not really what you think of as a podcast of sorts. It's more of like... I don't know what you would call it, but just I read these books, I record my thoughts, and hopefully some of my thoughts get you to read these books as well, or poems, so that you can also deepen, or, you know, expand your knowledge, deepen your understanding of what it is to be human, I think. Because I think that's... Anarchism is not real. It's just called being human and being an individual. And we give it a label, or at least we've taken the label that's been thrust upon us, because it's easier. But in the end, I think really all it is being human. That's all we can strive to be, in fact, because that is what we are. And so I hope you guys enjoyed this. If you did, send me a line on Mastodon. I haven't gotten very much feedback on Mastodon yet. I've actually gotten more emails than messages on Mastodon, which kind of surprised me, to be honest with you. But you can find all the contact information on the website. Oh, and before I go, huge changes are coming to the website. A friend of mine on Mastodon, he goes by the handle Bleak Gray. Months ago, he showed me this CSS, and this is shop talk, so if you don't like that, you can cut it off here. But he showed me this framework for CSS called Tachyons. And really, it's almost an entire development environment now. Or a whole development structure. And he brought it up again recently. And so I started trying to work on getting my site set up like that, because it makes things a lot easier. Things are, like the tags are simple and consistent, and you can, instead of having a div class equal blah 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 and it all being a random jumbly mess, it's a lot more organized. It's more than I could have ever come up with on my own, and which is what I've been doing, coming up with all my own CSS and HTML code. But so he showed me that, and I tried to start manually reworking it into my site. And I think, I don't know, probably not even a few hours passed, and he said, we were talking on Mastodon about it, and he mentioned Pelican static site generator again, and which is what I used to use for my blog, which is no longer up. But and I said, I love Pelican. And so I think probably 2 days later, he has a rough working model of Tachyons integrated into the static site generator for me. He is a wizard, I will tell you. He is a wizard of this kind of thing. I am merely a, what do they say? I am merely a tourist, it seems, compared to him, whenever it comes to any sort of programming, even something as simple as HTML and CSS. He is truly a wizard. So I'll shout out to him. That's Bleak Gray. And hopefully in the coming week or two, I should have a working site built and I can push that and get it set up. And also, on top of all of that, I have a Pine 64, or no, wait, what is it? It's made by Pine 64. It's a Rock Pro 64 with a metal case and a heat sink and everything else. And I have been kind of tracking over the last 4 or 5 years my public IP address to see how much it changes and if it changes. And so far, since I moved into this house, it has not changed. So I think I'm going to try using that as my primary site hosting, the Rock Pro 64, plus my own IP address and everything, route all the traffic to that with a backup to my regular Netlify plus GitLab setup. And yeah, that's what I think I'm going to end up doing. And hopefully it all goes smoothly. I'm sure it won't. But hopefully in the next few weeks, you'll see the site transform into something that looks much, much nicer than it currently looks, and a lot more mobile friendly. And yeah, that's pretty much it. So I will leave this here. We have gone a little bit longer than normal. So I hope you guys have a great day, and I hope you enjoyed this podcast.